You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, is Portugal the new Greece? As fears grow that Portugal will shortly require another bailout, we get the latest from Lisbon. Oil, oil everywhere, but not a drop to drink. We'll ask how Arab countries should prepare for water shortages and ask who might benefit from the Middle East's growing thirst. We'll look upwards to trace the trajectory of a new space race, as both China and Russia plan to plant their flags alongside America's on the moon. We'll also hear why egg prices have spiked in the Czech Republic to the extent that some Czechs are getting their own chickens, and some German grocery stores near the border are besieged by extremely excited shoppers. All that, plus more egg puns, plus some great music as well, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before all that, the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Libya has urged Mauritania's president today to hand over Muammar Gaddafi's intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi to face justice at home, winning in return what it called a promise of a good outcome in the case. Sanusi, who was Gaddafi's right-hand man before the Libyan leader's overthrow and death in a popular revolt last year, was arrested at Mauritania's Nouakchott airport after he arrived late on Friday on a flight from Morocco. A senior Libyan delegation to Mauritania feted President Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz for his brave stance in arresting Sanusi and reaffirmed Tripoli's wish for Sanusi to be extradited to Libya. Coffins containing the bodies of victims of a deadly attack in Toulouse have left the Jewish school at the scene of the shooting and have made their way to Paris before heading to Israel. The bodies were kept at the Ozar Hatorah school for an overnight vigil attended by sobbing parents and relatives. A gunman on a motorbike shot dead three children and a teacher at the Jewish school on Monday. Here, Bolton Wanderers manager Owen Coyle has said today that he has held a brief conversation with Fabrice Muamba for the very first time since the midfielder suffered a cardiac arrest during last weekend's FA Cup match at Tottenham Hotspur.
What we can say, Fabrice is still in intensive care, still remains critical, but yes, there has, as we know, been improvement. I've managed to be in to see myself, as his close family members, had a conversation, a few words exchanged, which is a great sign, but I must stress, it's still very much very early in the process. Doctors have stressed that point very, so that we all know what's involved. Fabrice is still a long way to go, but it's encouraging signs, and whilst that is the case, then that's really positive.
Muamba collapsed in the 41st minute of the match and only began breathing independently on Monday, some 48 hours after falling critically ill. Frontrunner Mitt Romney appears poised to widen his lead in the Republican presidential race with a victory today in Illinois, where polls show he has a comfortable edge over top rival Rick Santorum. Romney hopes a solid win in Illinois will give him a fresh burst of momentum in the volatile campaign for the White House and persuade Republicans to rally around the former Massachusetts governor and end an increasingly bitter nominating battle. Romney has more than twice as many delegates to the nominating convention as Santorum, and his campaign has argued that his rivals cannot catch him in the race to pick a challenger to Democrat President Barack Obama in the 6th of November election. Here in the UK, the Diamond Jubilee window, a gift from the members of both Houses of Parliament, was unveiled today to mark Britain's Queen Elizabeth's 60-year reign. The window was designed and made by the British artist John Retier, who worked with a dedicated and experienced team of draftsmen, painters and technicians in his studio in North London. He had previously worked on pieces including a stained glass window in Windsor Castle following the fire there in 1992.
They're Her Majesty's coat of arms, and it's her gift from the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and it's to celebrate her Diamond Jubilee, and I'm the one who was very lucky enough to win the tender to be asked to produce that.
And finally, China's national treasure, the giant panda, will become even more precious if one businessman succeeds in using their dung to grow organic green tea that he intends to sell for over $200 a cup. An entrepreneur in southwest China has been growing the tea in a mountainous area of Sichuan province using tons of dung from panda bears living at nearby breeding centres. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan, though I'm not sure why would panda dung be a selling point? I'd be keeping it quiet if I was him. Other newspaper headlines from around the world, just having a brief look at the few we have in. They're largely the Australian papers for Wednesday, tomorrow morning, which are dominated by the death of Jim Steins, a name which may not mean much outside Australia and indeed Ireland, but means a lot in Australia. The Age has a picture of Jim Steins covering its entire front page, as well as tributes from people up to and including the Prime Minister and her immediate predecessor, Kevin Rudd. Jim Steins was a football player. He played Australian rules football for Melbourne. He's died today of brain cancer at the age of 45. But he's a Dubliner by birth. He came from Ireland to Australia in the mid-1980s when a few Australian clubs recruited promising Gaelic football players. He went on to play a record 244 consecutive games, which requires a certain amount of physical fitness to play Australian football at that level for that long. And the best illustration of that, this is from Martin Flanagan's obituary in The Age. It says, in 1993, after a collision with a teammate, he was left without the capacity to breathe, in fear for his life and with ribs lifting the surface of his skin like a tent. Anyway, whatever it was, it meant missing 6 weeks. Apparently, the following Friday, Steins arrived at training and declared himself fit to play. After leaving football, he established a youth outreach foundation called the Reach Foundation, became chairman of Melbourne Football Club while terminally ill, rescued the club from oblivion, was twice named Victorian of the Year, and will be honoured with a full state funeral, no less than he deserves. But of the many tributes already coming in, the Australian Football League's chief executive, Andrew Demetriou, channels rather Mark Twain's assessment of Australian history when he says, it's an incredible story that if you wrote it, you couldn't believe it was anything other than fiction, yet all of it's true. We are all the better for knowing Jim Steins. Plenty more on him in the Australian papers. Martin Flanagan's obituary in The Age, especially well worth reading. It's 1807 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and this is the World Weather Report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And in the Northern Hemisphere, officially, the first day of spring. So how's it looking for Europe? Well, sunshine the next few days across France, Germany, the Alps, Austria, and right across to the Black Sea and Greece. Traditionally, in London, a little cloudier here. Also, if you're off to the coast of Spain, Costa Blanca, for example, it's cloudy, cool, with showers. So Wednesday's city outlook: in London, 14 degrees, partly cloudy. In Amsterdam, 15 and sunny. In Prague, 14 degrees, also sunny. And in Athens, a warm 23 with sunny skies. North America now, and the eastern US is almost baking, relatively speaking, for spring, that is. It's just so warm for March. Sometimes you get these mini heat waves early in the year across the US. They don't usually last very long. This one, however, has lasted over a week now, but it does look as though it's going to cool off a little bit, just a bit, by the end of the week. In the meantime, big storms rolling across the south of the US right now. Here's Wednesday's city outlook. Chicago, 28 degrees with sunshine. The average here is only 9. New York City, 21 and sunny in Central Park. Miami, 29, mostly sunny. In San Francisco, 17 degrees and partly cloudy. Around the world, South America, officially the first day of autumn here, but not as far as the weather's concerned. Sao Paulo, highs of 29 degrees with thunder showers. In Rio, it's the low 30s. In Santiago, sunny and 30 degrees. And across the ocean in Cape Town, around 25 degrees with some sunshine. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
It's 1809 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
A Monocle 24 Highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, you're welcome. Tämä on Monocle
24. The Ruokajalava. Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One with me, Andrew Muller. It increasingly looks as if the primary upshot of the euro is that financial panic can be spread more quickly over a wider area, though enough money has now apparently been found to enable Greece to keep the lights on, at least until the next bailout. Fears are growing over the finances of Portugal. Mohamed El Irian, the chairman of the bond fund PIMCO, believes that the original 78 billion euro rescue package will not be sufficient and that another whip round will shortly be required. Joining me now is Bruno Lopez, economics correspondent of the I newspaper in Lisbon. Good evening, Bruno.
Good evening.
How broke is Portugal?
Well, that's a fun question. I mean, it is broke. That's why basically we had to ask for financial assistance. Right now, the money that we have will carry us through the middle of next year. And the big question is whether we will need more money or not. I mean, right now it appears relatively clear that we will need more money and more time. Because I mean, if you look at the bond markets, we are very far from having a stable situation when it comes to our own interest rates. And there's still a high degree of a suspicion. So, I mean, definitely it would be dangerous for us to go back to the markets next year, even if someone would be interested in lending money to us. Because then the rates would be so high that our debt would spiral up right above 120%, that is more or less what the European Union decided that was sustainable for the Greek case.
How nervous have people in Portugal been watching the coverage of what's been occurring in Greece over the last year? How much of a feeling of where next is there?
Well, it's a mixed feeling. I mean, on one side, it's interesting to note that people here, they tend to look at Greece as an isolated case. I mean, they tend to say that...
Is that just wishful thinking, do you think?
Well, more or less. I mean, the news that we watch from Greece and that we read are always focusing on riots and on extreme political instability. And that is not... I mean, that's not happening here right now. There's a high degree of social consensus and of political consensus. That's mainly one of the good things that the whole country has in its favor. And I mean, people here, they know that things are rather bleak, but at least I mean, there's no violent confrontations. I mean, so that's basically the distinction that they make. And they also think that things in Greece are unmanageable. That's the view from here. I mean, and so if you talk to people here, they will say that, well, I mean, there's no way that they can stay in the eurozone. And so people tend to kind of forget about our own problems, which are in many ways similar to Greece.
Well, yeah, you say they're similar, but are they different at all? Is Greece just Portugal 18 months down the track, or are there fundamental differences which mean that it may not get that bad for Portugal?
Well, we have a lower debt level, but that I am afraid that will not be, that could not be just enough. I mean, the main question for us is whether we will be able to grow and to show to the markets that we will be able to pay our debt. I mean, that's the fundamental question here. And what the European Union says is that we could grow by an average of close to 2% from 2015 right up to 2020. And in that scenario, our debt ratio would be fine. The problem is that in the last 10 years, Portugal's experience with a very strong currency shows a very poor track record of growth. I mean, we grew just about 0.5% between 2002 and 2010. So you could argue, I mean, how will we grow now, right? I mean, that's a fundamental question.
Well, especially since by some forecasts, the economy is actually expected to contract 3.3% in the coming year.
Precisely. And next year, probably we could face a mild recession or complete stagnation. So in 2012 and 2013, it will be hard to regain financial markets' trust. From then on, there's a huge division of opinions. I mean, the European Union tends to sell the idea that with structural reforms, we will be able to leap forward and create this new fast growth. But there's really a high degree of doubt about that, because I mean we cannot devalue our own currency. We have no commercial policy, we have no monetary policy, and we still have a competitiveness problem. So there are risks to this growth scenario.
Well, that's the EU view of it, obviously. But what is Portugal's government saying, and what relationship does that have to the truth?
Yeah, well, Portugal's government is selling the same message. The government is very much aligned with the European Union general policy.
So there's no talk of defaulting or abandoning the euro or anything like that.
No. I mean, our finance minister, he used to run the economic studies department at Frankfurt for the European Central Bank. So he's completely aligned, and he sells the message that the structural reforms will be enough and we'll have success. So that's the official stance. I mean, I think that the government, and we talk to people we usually talk to them in private here, and they say that, I mean, I think that they know that they will have to ask for more money. I think they are playing the good student card. I mean, they don't want to ask for it. They want the European Union to recognize that even with Portugal doing all that is being kind of imposed, I mean, even by fulfilling the Troika program, that market confidence is not back, and that recognition must come from Brussels, not from Lisbon. That's the official stance here.
The austerity measures that have already been imposed by the government, are they having a significant effect on day-to-day life in Portugal?
Well, yes, huge. I mean, there's some recent data about private consumption here. Family's consumption has risen markedly for the past 10 years, and that's probably one of the big problems here. And the fall is just amazing. I mean, it's the sharpest fall since the beginning of the 80s. And the degree of unemployment level is record high. We have about 14%. Youth unemployment is above 30%. But still, I mean, people, you feel that there is this kind of passive resignation. So far, it hasn't translated into any violent protests. Discontentment here is very much framed by the unions, which tend to be, they don't have this huge violent element that you see in Athens, for instance, or even in Spain. So it's a much more institutional approach. So far things have been contained, and things are bleak. Of course, if you talk to people here, they will give you a very bleak and very grey scenery, but I mean, it's to be expected, right? It's a huge adjustment.
Bruno, I rather suspect we will be coming back to this story, though hopefully not as often as we've been coming back to Greece's travails. But for this evening, thank you very much. That was Bruno Lopez, economics correspondent of the Portuguese newspaper I, based in Lisbon. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be right back after a short break with the politics of water.
Monocle Films, the cinematic eye on the world that brings you crafted stories from affairs to business, culture to design. Plus our regular Monocle briefings featuring original concepts in travel, food and retail. This week we highlight bright and shiny hardware at the Singapore Air Show.
China marketed its upcoming C919, while on the smaller end, the Mitsubishi Regional Jet made its cabin mock-up premiere complete with a sushi bar in the stand. The first commercial jet ever made by a Japanese company, it's another promising model.
This and over 250 more films to be found in the program's menu on monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places, and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week, we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. The Middle East has never been exactly famous for its river deltas, tropical rainforests and waterfalls, but the region's inherent parchedness is becoming an increasing geopolitical concern. As nobody in the Arab world needs reminding, any number of wars have already been fought over resources, and there is no resource more fundamental than water. Joining me now is Afshin Malavi, a senior advisor at Oxford Analytica and a senior fellow at the New American Foundation. Good evening.
Good evening. It's good to be with you.
Is the current kind of water shortage, if you will, in the Middle East an entirely new problem, or has this been brewing for a while?
No, this has been brewing for a while, and now we're heading into kind of a crisis point. I mean, I liken this to a crisis in slow motion because it's not one of those issues that's going to come and suddenly we're going to find out that we're short on water. These things are gradually eroding people's economic development. In some cases, for example, in Yemen, we could, capital city of Yemen, run out of fresh water in 10 years or so. Basically, what we have right now is the Middle East North Africa region has the least renewable water supply per capita of any region in the world. It is considered one of the most high-stress water regions in the world. And this is an interesting twist of geological fate, isn't it? After all, this is a region known for its vast oil reserves, and yet it was not in those same kind of reserves of water. So this is a governance issue that's going to have to be handled at the highest levels of government, and it's going to have to be handled in cooperation. And just the last point here, when you think about rivers of the Middle East, you know, when you think of the Euphrates, for example, the Tigris, the Jordan, the Nile, the Litani, these are not, these names are evoke civilizations, don't they? And these rivers are dwindling. These rivers are not able to be provide the way they were providing for many years. I mean, civilization began with Euphrates and Tigris. So that's why in an article I wrote recently in The National, which is an Abu Dhabi-based publication, I called urgently for the need for water security agency, to be developed in the Middle East to handle slow brewing crisis.
You're right to point out the irony of having plentiful oil and not enough water. I mean, the illustration of that that sticks in my mind is driving out of Baghdad in 2003, I think, and seeing a petrol station owner hosing down his forecourt with petrol to clean it. As he explained, it was cheaper than using water on it, though I'd have been happier if he wasn't smoking while he was doing it. How bad could this get? Have we come close already to an actual Middle Eastern war over water?
You know, on occasion, Egypt has threatened war against Ethiopia because in the Nile River Basin is a basin that is shared by countries. And Ethiopia, many of the tributaries of the Nile River are in Ethiopia. Egypt has historical rights to the Nile River. There have been moments in which they felt that Ethiopia was damming the water, not doing enough to allow Egypt to have its rightful percentage river. And there have been, you know, attempts at there have been threats against Ethiopia. But the interesting things about water politics, you know, hydropolitics, if you will, is that there's and these actions, you know, there will be no solutions without cooperation. And so when you look at Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, all, you know, five of these you know, countries, regions, they all share the same resource. And so they're going to have to cooperate. And right now, in addition to income inequality, what we're seeing is water access inequality. So we very well could, over the next 5 to 10 years, start to see water tensions grow, and we could start to see wars fought over water.
You do suggest just then, and also in your article, that cooperation is the key to a solution. Indeed, there is an international water summit being convened in Abu Dhabi, I believe, next year. But to understate matters wildly, cooperation has never really been the strong point of the Arab nations. Do you think that a fundamental crisis like this will actually propel them towards an agreement?
It could, you know, one would hope it would. I mean, when you look at Pakistan and India have done, perennial antagonists, what they've done in terms of their cooperation with the Indus River, that does actually offer an example where antagonists have chosen to compromise over water. I think inherently people understand the importance of water. I mean, you know, it's not just the that it nourishes us. It's not just that it fights the plants that give us our oxygen. It's water's also in a very important part of industry. I mean, we wouldn't produce oil without water. Every single oil and gas company is also a water company. We can't produce electricity without water. Water is by far the fuel of the global economy, far more than oil is. And so I'm starting to see some of the early signs that regional leaders are for this crisis and are beginning to talk about solutions to this crisis. And the World Water Development Report, I think, was you know, very stark in their outlook, in which they said that what we're seeing is unprecedented growth in water demands is threatening all major development goals. And this is not just in the East North Africa region. You know, this is more than 1 billion people lack access to clean water. About 2.5 billion lack access to, you know, adequate sanitation. So this is global. This is not just focused on the Middle East North Africa region, but the Middle East North Africa region is where the crisis is most acute.
In water resources, as in so many other things. Ashvin Malavi of Oxford Analytica and the New America Foundation, thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's now time for some music. This is Kindness with Cyan. Well, I can take his time, leave the rest behind. That was Kindness with Cyan. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
LDNTYO. NYCMTY.
Thank you, Kylie. In the next half hour on Midori House, we will slip the surly bonds of Earth to consider the next installment of the space race, and we will literally wonder what EU farming policy has to do with the price of eggs. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Libya has urged Mauritania's president today to hand over Muammar Gaddafi's intelligence chief Abdullah al-Sanusi to face justice at home, winning in return what it called a promise of a good outcome in the case. Sanusi, who was Gaddafi's right-hand man before the Libyan dictator's overthrow and death in a popular revolt last year, was arrested at Mauritania's Nouakchott airport after he arrived late on Friday on a flight from Morocco. Coffins containing the bodies of victims of a deadly attack in Toulouse have left the Jewish school at the scene of the shooting and have made their way to Paris before heading to Israel. The bodies were kept at the Oza Hatorah school for an overnight vigil attended by sobbing parents and relatives. Bolton Wanderers manager Owen Coyle has said today that he held a brief conversation with Fabrice Muamba for the very first time since the midfielder suffered a cardiac arrest during last weekend's FA Cup match at Tottenham Hotspur. Muamba collapsed in the 41st minute of the match and only began breathing independently on Monday, some 48 hours after falling critically ill. Frontrunner Mitt Romney appears poised to widen his lead in the Republican presidential race with a victory today in Illinois, where polls show he has a comfortable edge over top rival Rick Santorum. Romney hopes a solid win in Illinois will give him a fresh burst of momentum in the volatile campaign for the White House and persuade Republicans to rally around him and end an increasingly bitter nominating battle. And finally, here in the UK, the Diamond Jubilee window, a gift from members of both Houses of Parliament, was unveiled today to mark Britain's Queen Elizabeth's 60-year reign. The window was designed and made by a British artist who worked with a dedicated and experienced team of draftsmen, painters and technicians in his studio in North London. And those are the stories at the moment here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. The two golf balls thwacked across the lunar surface by Alan Shepard in 1971 may get to play a few more rounds yet. Russia is planning a manned mission to the moon, and so is China. A growing number of other countries also have ambitions of reaching for the stars. Though it might sound like the subject of an email you'd be best off deleting, even Nigeria has a space program now. Space is pretty big and everything, but isn't it all going to get a bit crowded? Joining me now is Roger Hanberg. He's a professor of political science at the University of Central Florida and an expert on space politics. Good evening, Roger.
Good evening.
Are Russia and China serious about this, or are they just posturing?
China's definitely serious about it, because China sees this as a logical extension of their activities that mark them as a great power. You know, they got the economic stuff pretty well. Everyone acknowledges that. But on the technology side, you know, they've been considered to be farther behind, and now they're catching up. The Russian case is a little more puzzling for the fact that the Russian space program has some severe problems. But it's part of Putin's general emphasis on building a strong Russia. You know, in a sense, he's a nostalgist. He wants to return to the good old days of the Soviet Union.
You talk there about, you know, China, you know, embellishing itself as a great power by sending men to the moon, and Russia harking back to a stronger, prouder day. Is that really the essence of it? Is there any scientific or strategic point in sending men to the moon at this point?
There's going to be some scientific stuff just because you're there physically on the ground or on the lunar surface. But the reality is, you know, going to the moon, the Americans did it, okay, so that's the marker of what you got to do to be considered a prestigious space player. But the economic part of it is a little more dim. It's difficult to know what you're going to get out of that if you think at some point you want your space program to pay for itself. As long as it's kind of a prestige project, you know, you get your payment in terms of feeling good and being marked by other states as a powerful state. But there's no real economic stuff. They talk about mining the moon for helium-3, which can be used, hopefully, in fusion reactors. There's only one minor problem. You got to have a fusion reactor first. We don't have one. I started this 30 years ago. They said fusion reactors will be here in 30 years. 30 years later, they're saying fusion reactors will be here in 30 years. You know, they're doing a lot, but it's not close to anything that would make it a viable argument to go to the moon to mine helium-3.
Would the spectacle of, you know, cosmonauts and their Chinese equivalent capering at Tranquility Base encourage America to get back into it, or would America's reaction be, we did this, you know, 43 years ago, big deal?
No one knows. I think that probably the United States would not be driven to do that. If the United States was going to do anything, it would go beyond the moon. But the difficulty is we're discovering, if you follow the news, it's becoming increasingly dangerous. We're becoming aware of how increasingly dangerous it is for people to be in outer space for a long period of time, microgravity, radiation, all the other things. They're having brain and eye damage from relatively short missions. And now you're going to send someone 300 days out to the Mars and bring them back, and that's a 600-day exposure. They may not be alive when they come back, or they may be pretty severely disabled.
So if a manned mission to Mars, which was vaguely muttered about, wasn't it, during the closing stages of the George W. Bush administration, if that seems unlikely, what would be the diplomatic and strategic ramifications of a greater and more obvious Russian and Chinese presence in space or on the moon? What effect would that have on diplomacy on back down here?
I don't know that it would have any in the long term. In the short term, there would be obviously some posturing and people talking about how we're now, you know, superior, et cetera. But, you know, if you go back to the beginnings of the space age after the Sputnik went to orbit in October of 1957, people talked about, oh, we're going to put missiles on the moon, so we're going to shoot. Well, they figured out missiles on the moon are wonderful, but by the time you launch them, get them to the Earth, the war will be over. By a day or so.
That notwithstanding, how big a concern is the militarization of space?
Space is already militarized. The question we talk about is it weaponized?
Okay.
If you go, you think most of the satellites that have gone to orbit historically have been military satellites. The Soviets launched thousands of satellites, basically in part because their satellites had a shorter lifespan. The Americans have launched hundreds of military satellites over the years, but none of them carry weapons. That's the key variable.
Well, how big a concern is that then?
Not as big a concern as I think the space cadets would like you to think. The reason is because if you have a weapon platform in orbit, it's going to have to be relatively low orbit, so that means it's vulnerable to attack, you know, and you have to have many of them. You know, what was it, in Star Wars, when they talked about, toward the end, they talked about having a little weapon system floating around that would attack missiles when they came. You need 3,000 or 4,000 of them to cover the globe, because if you're up in the high orbit, you're too far away. A missile can come and go all the way to the target, and you never have a chance to shoot at it. So you got to be relatively close. And if you want to use them as a weapon, you got to have them close also to be effective.
As we were discussing earlier, George W. Bush made a few noises towards the end of his presidency about a Mars mission. What's your sense of the current administration's enthusiasm or otherwise for space expeditions?
The Obama administration is not enthusiastic about that big a thing, primarily because of budget reasons. NASA's problem is holding on to its budget. And see, what you have is a split in the American space community between those who say we need to do like Apollo. We set a big goal, and then we pay what money is necessary to get there. Others say, let's build the infrastructure. This is the Obama approach. Let's build the infrastructure. Let's build a rocket that can carry payload and go beyond the lunar orbit. So what you have is basically you're building the tools. Well, that's not glamorous.
No.
People prefer to, you know, have some guy come down and plant another American flag on the moon or on Mars or one of the Martian moons. But the point is, you plant all the flags you want. By international law, they're useless because they do not symbolize ownership. They're just there to say we were first, and that's all that the flag meant when the Americans landed in 1969.
Well, they were first. If you're a betting man, though, just quickly, who will be second and by when, do you think?
I think at the present rate, I think it would be the Chinese, but I don't think it would be by 2020. It's probably going to be in the mid-20s. Because Chinese have done what the Americans and the Soviets didn't have the opportunity to do in the 60s. They have no competition, really. So they are moving at a measured pace. Their great anxiety, I think, is having a failure. Okay, well, so they are all careful.
Well, so we're not holding our breath then. Roger Hanberg of the University of Central Florida, thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we will be back with an extremely exciting story after this.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
In the Czech Republic, there is currently something of a scramble for eggs. Strap yourself in, folks. There's more where that came from. A shortage has been exacerbated by the tardiness of many Czech farmers in implementing a new EU directive on conditions in hen farms. An egg shortage and consequent exorbitant prices has seen many Czechs resorting to poaching eggs from neighbouring Germany. It's clearly no yoking matter, but when will it all be over? On the line from Prague, if he's managed to stand all that, is Martin Hoffman, owner of the bakery, Bake Show Praha. Good evening, Martin.
Good evening, sir. Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. What impact has this egg shortage and price hike had on your business?
Well, we all hope it's not going to take long, so we sort of don't panic. The price is sort of tripled, and there's been a shortage for a little while, or we just couldn't get like a real good size eggs. We're getting like small eggs, so we had to use two instead of one. But we're all hoping for not taking so long and getting back to normal, I hope.
How sudden has this been? Did it sort of happen overnight, or has it been building gradually?
More or less sort of overnight, I would say. No one sort of really expected it. So it just happened, and all the suppliers like getting short eggs, and price is revving up, and it's really quite quick, you know, I have to say.
And what kind of measures has your business been taking to deal with it? Have you been shopping in Germany or thinking about buying chickens?
To be honest, it's not that, you know, butter's probably more I worry about than eggs. So we use koala. We go through probably around 1,000 eggs a week. But it's not so much of the cost, I have to say honestly, that, you know, doesn't make me happy, but it's not the biggest thing we're using in the business, even though we go through 1,000 eggs a week, as I say.
But have you and other businesses like you, I mean other bakeries especially, it must be a huge problem for, have you found yourself having to raise your prices?
We didn't raise prices, we're sort of waiting, and I spoke to the supplier today. He said there's enough eggs and they should be going down, which everyone I think it's expected to go down, because if you can shop anywhere else and if you bring them from anywhere else, why should the prices stay high as they are now?
I mean, the shortage has been caused by Czech farmers not implementing this new EU directive on conditions in hen farms. Why haven't they done it?
Yeah. I don't know, to be honest. Apparently they've been warned and they didn't do it, and probably they're waiting till the last minute, or they didn't think the EU is going to be so strict. I spoke to an English guy. He said the same thing is in, just today, you know, in a shop. He said the same thing is in England as well. And the prices are like triple two or something. So I don't know how. And he said the same thing is the EU thing. So I don't know how. It's only Czech Republic, or it's taken action in other countries.
I mean, it hasn't become, in certainly in Britain, anything like the issue that it has in the Czech Republic. But has it become a big political question? Even President Václav Klaus has ventured into it now and sort of started blaming the EU for this.
Well, he never liked the EU thing as well, so I think he likes to take the blame. But no, I don't think it's going to be such a huge deal, to be honest, because it doesn't, like, if you go to shops now, there's enough eggs, you know, everywhere. The price are higher. I mean, the question is if it's going to stay high. I mean, it's probably a good thing that the chickens have more space in the cage, isn't it? But...
I mean, this kind of thing aside, are Czech people still generally pleased and happy to be part of the European Union?
It's a question, you know. If I can speak for myself, that, you know, we had it here before. If you put money in one pocket and then redistribute it, it's never going to be right, you know. That's what I think. So my personal opinion, in many ways, it's good, but in... you know, in real life, it's quite hard to be fair, and it's hard to find the balances.
Well,
only my personal opinion. I don't want to be, you know, speaking for all the country, because it wouldn't be fair.
Well, it's to be hoped that in due course the prices come back down and you have all the eggs you need. And I'm not going to do any more egg jokes. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Martin Hoffman from Bake Shop Praha in Prague. You're listening to Midori House. It's coming up for 1848 in London. This is another song which also has very little to do with eggs. This is Prince with Musicology. That was Prince with Musicology. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the realm of theatrical prizes, the International Ibsen Award may not be as well known as the Tonys or the Oliviers, but it's a much better one to win, as this year's laureate, the German director Heiner Goebbels, would surely attest. The doubtless tastefully minimalist trophy is accompanied by a cheque for 2.5 million Norwegian crowns, or about €330,000. The size of the state-funded gong reflects something of the pride Norwegians still feel about Ibsen. On the phone now we have Therese Bjørnebø, a member of the committee of the International Ibsen Award, theatre critic and the editor of the Shakespeare Tidskriftet. Good evening, Therese. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, good evening.
The Ibsen Prize was founded in 2007. What was the reason for it?
It was founded as a consequence, or after the big centenary, the celebration of the jubilee of Ibsen, 100 mm-hmm. years after his death. And in that year, 2006, there were lots of events all over the world, and also a big celebration going on the whole year in Oslo, but also at the Ibsen Festival, which has been arranged since the early 90s in Oslo, and which has also had a very, very big impact on Norwegian theatre.
How widely read is Ibsen in Norway still?
Oh, he is, of course, read in schools. Maybe in a too young age for many, because his plays are quite tricky, actually. But... his figures and a lot of quotations, as with Shakespeare in English, are of course very known. So he has come into the vocabulary, and also his figures as you know, pictures, images.
I mean, his most notable works were published and originally performed in the late 19th century. How did they come to travel so well, do you think?
Well, I think that he had he had a big impact in German at a time when it was a realistic turn, you know, from idealism towards realism. And then when his place traveled in the world, maybe, or I would say that a doll's house has been the most important play in terms of women's liberations and so on. It's probably his absolutely much most influential play.
I mean, how unusual and important, I guess, was his portrayal of women? Because unlike many writers of his time, he went out of his way to create strong female parts. How important was that?
Oh, it was extremely important, of course, and it still is, because in the theatre, because there are not so many strong female roles who really have most female roles have a motivation which is about love. But his, of course, love is also important in Ibsen, but his, it's more complex, his women. And with Nora, of course, if you compare Nora to Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, who also was a woman who left her husband and children, it's a very big difference. And Tolstoy's novel can, you know, be read as a warning about doing that.
I mean, with these ideas of Ibsen's, were they popular at the time, or were they regarded as controversial and scandalous?
They were absolutely regarded as controversial, yes. And today you can say it's when they stage a doll's house today, many directors do change it because the play is not only about the very fulfillment of a woman and her liberation, but it also pictures a very materialistic world. And those forces are, you know, also part of his relevance today in a neoliberalistic society where people are very afraid of falling down the ladder and climbing to the material values are very strong. So these aspects of his play, I think, has a relevance and the contradictions between the values that the bourgeoisie class tries to promote or to climb to, with family values and so on, while he at the same time shows that people in the very family goes out of their way because of money and they destroy their own families and their wives and children.
All of which are depressingly universal themes, which is probably why his plays developed a universal pertinence. Teresa Bjornebo from the Committee of the International Ibsen Award, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
That's all for today's edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. Thank you all. Next on Monocle 24 is Section D with Hugo MacDonald. Stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House. I've been Andrew Muller. Goodbye.